Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles the British-born pianist Imogen Cooper. She performs Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 9 in concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. A conversation with Tom Caden, president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance. A new report by his organization examines the decline in local, state, and federal government funding for the arts. Susan Lewis takes us to the Philadelphia Theatre Company for Anna Deavere Smith's one-woman show, Let Me Down Easy. And we look ahead to a new exhibition at Locke's Gallery in Philadelphia. The Insolent Eye pays tribute to the early 20th century French author Alfred Jarry, who would be highly influential on subsequent generations of visual artists and musicians. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
You can almost take the words out of the mouths of music lovers who hear British pianist Imogen Cooper for the first time. Where has she been all this time? This star student of Alfred Brendel has been on the British scene for decades and even slipped in and out of Philadelphia in the 1990s. But not until she hit her mid-50s did she begin creating an international reputation. Now at age 61, she visits the US 3 times a year, often at the invitation of conductors like Simon Rattle and Colin Davis, and has an acclaimed new recording of Schubert piano sonatas. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns talked with the pianist this week to find out what took her, and maybe us, so long.
Explanations are never simple when an artist has a late-blooming career. Like conductor Yasha Hornstein or composer Leos Janacek, pianist Imogen Cooper faced the challenges of getting her inner life in order before she could function at full speed in the outer world. She's more forthcoming about this in the U.S. than at home in London, where public displays of introspection are not so common.
There is the force with which it comes out when you're more consciously in touch with it. And there is simply also, you know, getting your act together, getting your life together. That, too, some people do much earlier. I have had a little bit of bad luck, yes, but there you go. Sometimes wrong place, wrong time, fashions changing, music business changing, being brought up in a completely different era. You know, I can honestly say my feeling is simply the growing of strength of what there was inside me, which I just felt it getting out there much more powerfully.
There was a marriage in there that wasn't working, as well as a disconnect between the dreams she had about her life and how to bring them into being. But few musicians have so clearly enjoyed the benefits of 3 rich, different pianistic cultures. When very young, she spent several years in Paris, studying with great artists such as Jacques Thévrier, then migrated to Vienna to study with Brendel, who was an apostle of the great Swiss pianist Edwin Fischer. At home in England, she studied with the master of Mozartian elegance, Clifford Curzon. So when you break down her playing, the elements include Germanic X-ray vision, British discretion that assures that all expressive content would never distort the music's contour, and a fleet, clear way of getting around the keyboard that was distinctly French. So what's missing? Perhaps the dark side of Mozart and Schubert.
I, not being a genius, have needed 50-plus years to actually fully get to the darkness of these works because, as it happens, my years between my 30s and my 50s were quite difficult ones, quite stormy for all sorts of reasons. And I have caught up with a little bit of darkness through living that bit longer. But I think people like Mozart and Schubert, they had it condensed within them.
With insights like that, it's perhaps no wonder that Imogen Cooper wanted a cozier stage configuration with the Philadelphia Orchestra, as violinist David Booth observed in a rehearsal.
She wanted everything in the orchestra as close as possible. At one point, she asked the first violins to move up closer to her. She said she liked to feel the warmth on her back. It brings about almost like a chamber music-like feeling to performing.
Unlike many soloists who fly into Philadelphia on the day of their concerts, Cooper was here days before. It was important for her to be with the music and to work with the orchestra as opposed to just staking out the soloist musical territory. Especially important to her were those wind instrument solos, which were extremely innovative in Mozart's early years, especially in the Piano Concerto No. 9, which is full of duets between the piano and different parts of the orchestra.
The woodwind were not used like this before. Mozart started blossoming and flowering, and I was thinking it must have seemed revolutionary at the time. I mean, in this instance, there are only two oboes, two horns. But what these instruments do in the way of expressiveness and speaking power and articulation is completely new.
That articulation is best accentuated by historically informed performance practices, yet another source from which Cooper draws. Yet no one aspect of her playing, says David Booth, gets out of hand.
It never sounds overdone or too much. She just has absolutely wonderful taste, and everything is wonderfully balanced and very even. And also she's very acutely sensitive to the constantly changing psychological feelings and facets of Mozart's writing.
Balance may not be the sexiest attribute of a concert pianist. What matters, it seems, is what's behind it.
I have a theory that what really matters in life sits within us from the start. Either we tap into it or we don't. When I was a little girl, I remember sitting on a hillside in the north of England with my father. Spring was just coming, and I had the most extraordinary sensation. It was unbelievably beautiful. It was a sort of sense of eternity, awareness of the presence of God. I'm not quite sure what I mean by God anymore, but I know what I mean by that feeling. And really getting back to that, and the sense of the eternal, not necessarily in religious terms, just the eternal.
That's not to suggest that all of Cooper's advice to young pianists is a lot of gentle, amorphous, interior philosophy. Much the opposite. The last thing she'll say is to wait for good things to come to you.
Women have a more secret psychology. The best of women, I think, remains secret longer. Well, am I talking about myself? Yes, probably. I've made it my job a little bit to make them aware that there is no time for dreaming and that one has to learn how to go out and hit people with the music. For women of a certain temperament, I mean, I can think, for instance, of two young women who are not go-out-and-getters. I've seen them dress poorly on the stage, and I've really screamed at them. I've said, look, you've got what it takes. You're not having to flaunt it. Just go with it, but don't deny it. We're not interested. We just want to play the instrument. I said, you're idiots. You're idiots.
Now, when I think of Imogen Cooper, I think of sensible shoes with stiletto heels.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Imogen Cooper performs Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 9 with the Philadelphia Orchestra under guest conductor Stefan Deneuve at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8 and tomorrow afternoon at 2. The program also features works by Dutilleux, Debussy, and Roussel.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Alfred Jarry was a French playwright, novelist, and poet, active in Paris in the late 19th and early 20th century. He's best known for discovering the pseudoscience of pataphysics, the study of imaginary solutions. His best-known work is Ubu Roi, or King Ubu, an 1896 absurdist play satirizing the power, greed, and evil practices of the ruling classes and the bourgeoisie. Its stark, unconventional, and outlandish content and presentation would later become a touchstone for the surrealist movement. The Insolent Eye, an exhibition opening next weekend at Locke's Gallery as part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, pays tribute to Jarry's influence in art. It features an installation by the contemporary German artist Rebecca Horn, William Kendridge's film reflecting on the post-apartheid truth and reconciliation process in his native South Africa, as well as paintings by the late great Philadelphian Thomas Chimes. Adding historical context are works by Marcel Duchamp, Max Ernst, Pablo Picasso, and Man Ray. Locke's is a commercial gallery with a high profile in the international art world, housed in a grand Renaissance revival building on Washington Square in Philadelphia that has the ambience of a museum. Unusual in the commercial world, this exhibition features items borrowed from public collections as well as works for sale, which together tell the story of Alfred Jarry in art. The curator of the Insolent Eye is Marie-Claire Gröning.
The starting point was that we were thinking about those artists. Duchamp is very important in Philadelphia, Thomas Chimes also, and there is something that links them all, and together with William Kentridge, Rebecca Hearn, that we studied afterwards, there is a way of thinking that comes from Jarry in all those artworks.
This is pathophysics, this pseudoscience.
Pataphysics, this also irreverent way of talking about the modern man and the contemporary man, actually, and contemporary political events. If you look at Pablo Picasso and William Kentridge on two different continents, Europe and Africa, one century apart, you have two artists who borrow the character Ubu Roi from Alfred Jarry's play. And to talk about political events, Picasso talked about the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, and William Kentridge's film is all about post-apartheid South Africa. That is the force of Alfred Jarry's inventions. They're so striking and impactful that they can lend themselves to other minds, other artists, other ways of expressing other subjects. But the way of thinking and the way of expressing the message, this way of trying to provoke the audience.
The message that Jarry was trying to present was that the ruling powers and the bourgeoisie were inherently evil or misguided. Is that right?
It's not really the subject he was addressing, it's the way he addressed it. Of course, he was a provocateur of his time. He was a kind of dandy, so he was against all those bourgeoisie rules. But the main thing is not just the content, it's just the way he was addressing those issues. And the way he was staging his play, Ubu Roi, with very sparse stage design, and the way he was aggressively provoking the minds of the audience is really what makes him so unique.
And how then does that manifest itself in the canvases that are on the walls here, in the sculptures that are around the gallery, in the movie we see projected on the wall? Is it the sparseness then? Is it the style?
Yeah, it's totally the style. When Kentridge makes this collage of film documentary, real photos from the atrocity of the apartheid, and mixed with his own drawings, and that's what he says himself, it's almost impossible to encompass the whole meaning of it if you don't use your imagination. And he's talking to your imagination. He's not talking to your analytical intelligence.
So then the selection of works. This is a commercial gallery, so it's not that you can call MoMA or you can call other public galleries and say, can you lend us X because we have an exhibition? Because you're about selling paintings. They're about exhibiting for the public good. So how does one then go about curating a show in a commercial gallery when you don't have those public options?
That's actually very true. Curating an exhibition in a commercial gallery means that most of the artworks, with a few exceptions, are on sale, meaning that when you see this show, it's a very specific thrill to be in front of an artwork that doesn't belong to a museum collection. There is this hypothesis that this artwork, you could bring it back home, and that gives this artwork a very different meaning, a very different sensitivity. I think to me, the most important thing is that intellectually, it's more challenging because you would have to make a choice. And I think when you have to decide which artwork, whatever the price, whatever the fame of the artist, you would like to bring back home, that's a whole story, and that's a real statement. So I guess you look at those artworks differently.
Marie-Claire Gruning, curator of The Insolent Eye, Alfred Jarry and Art. It opens at Locke's Gallery on South Washington Square in Philadelphia on Friday and runs through May 13th. Anna Deavere Smith is an actor, playwright and author who has been active since the early 1970s, creating and performing theatre pieces based on the words of real people. Her one-woman shows exploring topical subjects have garnered awards. Fire in the Mirror, about race riots in Brooklyn between black and Jewish neighbors, received an Obie and was a finalist for the 1992 Pulitzer Prize. Twilight Los Angeles, about civil unrest after the 1992 Rodney King beatings, garnered 2 Tony nominations and an Obie. Smith has also appeared in a number of films and is known to TV audiences for roles in The West Wing and in the Showtime Network's Nurse Jackie. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Smith's approach in a one-woman show now at the Philadelphia Theatre Company. Let Me Down Easy is a collection of stories of human frailty, resilience, and encounters with the healthcare system.
Let me down easy.
You know, those are words of broken heart. They are words of, they can be interpreted as broken love.
Anna Deavere Smith portraying Reverend James H. Cone, a 70-year-old African-American author and professor from Union Theological Seminary in New York City. In this version of Let Me Down Easy, he is the first of 20 portraits selected from 300 interviews over nearly a dozen years on 3 continents.
Let me down easy. Those are words of broken heart.
Let Me Down Easy is part of a series, On the Road, A Search for the American Character, an idea conceived in the early 70s when Anna Deavere Smith was not long out of college trying to make it as an actor. She wanted to give voice to people not commonly represented on the stage.
I was very concerned about the lack of range in my generation of the theater of whose stories could be told.
She also wanted to cut through the conventional, comfortable patterns of speech that can mask what people really think. A linguist she met at a party suggested 3 questions to ask.
Have you ever come close to death? Do you know the circumstances of your birth? And have you ever been accused of something that you did not do? That was how I was able to take off and make my first piece.
In the beginning, Smith performed for university audiences. Later, she created full-fledged plays. Her award-winning shows in the early 90s, Fire in the Mirror and Twilight Los Angeles, focused on unjust accusations and civil unrest.
She put some depth and a human face on what could really just appear to be a large social or political topic.
Sarah Goronczyk, producing artistic director of the Philadelphia Theater Company, says Let Me Down Easy shows a variety of responses to the human physical condition.
The fragility of the human body and the strength of the human spirit in getting through certain ordeals, the grace of average people as well as some not so average but more famous people in just pulling their way through life.
The idea for Let Me Down Easy was the unexpected fruit of a special project in 2000. Smith was invited to the Yale School of Medicine to interview doctors and patients and create a performance for Grand Rounds, normally a lecture for doctors and students.
I was very nervous about doing that, didn't want to do it. Glad I did, because when I sat down and started interviewing patients, all I had to do was turn on the tape recorder and ask one question: what happened to you? And people were expressing themselves in such amazing ways.
Smith, who had been working on another play about politics in Washington, was astonished by the candor.
One man who had had a heart transplant brought in his granddaughter, who read to me from her diary about what it was like when she thought Grandpa was going to die. One woman took her clothes off, showed me her scars. I was like, whoa. What question are they answering without me asking it? Have you ever come close to death?
One of those interviewed was then Associate Dean of the Medical School, Ruth Katz, who also had been diagnosed with breast cancer and had to go into the hospital. She told us of her story as a patient, which made it into the Grand Rounds performance and the subsequent play.
One of the oncology fellows came in, and his opening line was, "What kind of cancer do you have? We can't find your charts to tell us." The word I used was, "That's appalling." And his response was, "Oh, don't worry, you're not the only one. This happens here all the time." So that led to a series of questions.
Katz was quizzed about her history.
"Are you working?" I responded, "Yes." He said, "Where are you working?" And I said, "At the medical school." At which point, this resident sort of looked up, because he had been busily not acknowledging me eye to eye, but writing all kinds of notes, looked up and said, at this medical school, and I responded, at the Yale School of Medicine, and he found my records in 30 minutes.
Anna Deavere Smith's experience at the medical school prompted her to continue interviewing on this subject and to create a full-length play.
And here I saw, man, I have a chance to get this unbelievable language of people who feel compromised physically but keep going because of the resilience of their spirit. And they are going to bank on that to have the best that they can of the preciousness of life.
In 2008, Let Me Down Easy was staged in New Haven and Boston. It opened off Broadway in 2009 and is now on a national tour. Using different accents, patterns of speech, mannerisms, and posture, Smith portrays a variety of men and women, young and old, white and people of color, rich and poor. Some are famous, like Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong, former Texas Governor Ann Richards, and TV movie critic Joel Siegel, all who fought cancer. Others are ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, without financial resources, like the director of an orphanage in disease-ravaged South Africa and a public hospital doctor tending to patients in New Orleans after Katrina. Some speak of finding comfort. Smith's elderly aunt recalls putting her hands under her mother's arms. A musicologist finds the music of an early romantic composer who died young a compelling response to mortality, as does Anna Deavere Smith herself.
The piece of music that I kept going back to was Schubert's Quintet, which I listened to after my mother passed away.
Smith channels each character one right after the other, says Philadelphia Theater Company's Sarah Goronczyk.
Some are just howlingly funny, and some are kind of sad and ruminative. It's just hard to explain this mixture of Anna plus this character she'll do equals this third component.
Ruth Katz first saw herself portrayed at Yale.
Here she was doing my mannerisms with my hands. It wasn't just my accent. You said, geez, that can't be right. Well, everyone in the audience I knew came up and said, boy, did she get you right. Absolutely dead on.
In her search for the American character, Anna Deavere Smith looks for the differences in people.
One of my muses along the way, represented in this play, is a rodeo cowboy, bull rider, Republican, right wing, curved conservative as they come. That's what I'm looking for, is these human cousins who, on the face of it, I have nothing in common with.
But what we do have in common cuts to the core.
This experience we have together in life is so amazing. That's what I think these 20 people bring us to. Whether it's through humor, whether it's through indignation and rage and a sense of, this is just not fair. Not just for me, in fact, for that other person. It's not fair. And then sometimes we're given little prescriptions about how to live. Reverend Gomes says at one point, the most important thing you can do for someone is to be with them when they die.
Being human has all sorts of limitations. Our physical bodies are such fragile, temporary homes. But being human also offers great possibilities when awareness replaces denial. Along with sadness, there can be joy. With hurt, healing. We can be alone, but we can also be there for one another, on the streets of America, in an orphanage in South Africa, or at the bedside anywhere of someone we love.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Anna Deavere Smith's Let Me Down Easy is at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia through April 10th. Even with reports of some budding green shoots of economic recovery, the budget season looks bleak for government funding for arts and culture. Congress and President Obama agree that cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities are necessary. While Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett supports funding the State Council on the Arts, he's proposed cuts to higher education and tourism, both areas that fuel cultural activity. In Philadelphia, Mayor Michael Nutter supports continued funding for the city's Office of Arts, Culture and the Creative Economy, and keeping the city's support of the Philadelphia Cultural Fund unchanged at $1.8 million. Much of this, though, is contingent on developments in Harrisburg. The consistent position of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, the regional arts advocacy organization, is that arts and culture are both necessary and essential. because, quote, arts and culture support a vibrant creative economy that creates 62,000 jobs all over the Commonwealth, pumps $2 billion into the economy, generates $283 million in tax revenues, and helps educate and prepare kids to compete in the 21st century. Though the GPA has the data to back up these claims, there are those who have little interest in arts and culture and believe the government has no business spending their tax dollars on what they consider unnecessary and unessential, a point I put to Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance President Tom Caden earlier this week. How do you react to people who say, I don't want my tax dollars being spent on a bunch of people painting pretty pictures or doing funny dances?
I think that's a pretty narrow perception of what it means to be culturally active. And I think the reality is that everybody has a vested interest in arts and culture's role in our society and in our economy. So if you want to be sort of entirely selfish just in terms of the tax base alone, the nominal investment that's made at the government level in the arts is more than paid over many times in terms of its return to the economy in terms of tax dollars, tax revenues that are generated, jobs that are created. And most importantly, I think the education of the next generation that are going to keep this Commonwealth strong.
And clearly your interest is in making sure that all people who hold public office are aware of that. That said, even if they are aware of it, it's easier to cut arts funding than it is to cut recreation infrastructure.
I think when everyone's looking at the budget, there's this sort of tendency to look narrowly at one specific line item and people look for their particular interest. But I think what you've got to take a look at is the overall budget. So let's take the state budget, for example. It's a $27, $28 billion budget with a $4 billion shortfall. The contribution to the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts right now is $8 million. It's tiny. Just to put it in perspective, it's about 70 cents for everybody who resides in the state. So if you're looking to close a $4 billion shortfall, to take a look at a budget line item that represents $8 million that's already been cut in half in the past couple of years, it's pretty tiny. But then when you look at what's the return on that investment for the people who live in the state, it's immense in terms of its impact on individual lives, the way it's changing lives for seniors and senior centers who are recapturing their memories, for kids who are in at-risk youth centers, and then again the return for the taxpayer in terms of how much money is being pumped into the economy by this segment. It's a $2 billion industry. So to think about cutting a very small appropriation and putting those things at risk is sort of more than penny wise and pound foolish.
But would you be putting things at risk? Wouldn't these things carry on regardless? Because there is, the undefeatable human spirit to get things done, and people are passionate about the arts, and they're probably going to do it without this injection from government.
Look, I think some artistic creativity and production is inevitable. The thing that you put at risk is access for all people, and what you don't want is for arts and culture, which is so critical to the development of kids and the vibrancy of our economy, to become the sole province of a very narrow group of people and institutions who are wealthy. What we're talking about is we need to make sure that all of our kids are growing up with access to arts and culture at an affordable rate. And so the small portion of funding that comes from public sources is really critical to maintaining that access. So I think this is really about making sure that every kid who's growing up gets access to the kind of creativity and the kind of creative learning that will enable them to be competitive as they grow older.
But from a political point of view, are we ever going to vote with our paintbrushes, our violin bows? Are we ever going to vote on the basis of how well supported the arts are? Surely the more critical things that people make decisions about who they're going to vote for are things like the money in their pocket, the actual physical infrastructure they live in, whether the streetlights are on, whether there are holes in the road.
I think people vote for good public service and responsible government. And I would argue that responsible government includes arts and culture, because you can't do is give short shrift to the next generation that's growing up. I think that would be really poor policy.
But that argument has been used in the way we fund arts in public schools, for instance, and it still got cut.
Look, I mean, there are decisions made every single day that may or may not be rational. My argument is basically to say what we need to pursue is sound policy more than sound politics.
Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance President Tom Caden. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.